From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. September 11th is also the 30th anniversary of the bloody coup that overthrew the Chilean president Salvador Allende and installed the military dictator Augusto Pinochet. The U.S. covert efforts to help overthrow Allende and its covert support of Pinochet are revealed in over 24,000 recently declassified documents. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Peter Kornbluh, who analyzes those documents and reprints many of them in his new book, The Pinochet File. We'll also talk with Jack Devine, who was a CIA agent stationed in Chile at the time of the coup. And rock critic Ken Tucker remembers singer-songwriter Warren Zevon. He died Sunday at the age of 56. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is cutting short a state visit to India and returning home after two suicide bombings left at least 13 people dead in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. The latest bombing struck a popular cafe in central Jerusalem. NPR's Julie McCarthy describes the chaos at the scene.
Just a huge drum of ambulances and rescue workers and police and soldiers here in the center of Jerusalem tonight.
A few hours earlier, another bomber attacked a crowd at a bus station near an army base in suburban Tel Aviv. A faction of Hamas has claimed responsibility for the bombings. Pentagon officials defended President Bush's request for an additional $87 billion in funding for operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz told a Senate panel that the additional spending was essential to the war on terrorism.
The costs are large, but it is a battle that we can win, and it is a battle that we must win. Because victory in this battle will be a major victory in the war on terrorism, and a major defeat for the global terrorist networks.
Senator Carl Levin, the senior Democrat on the committee, complained that Wolfowitz had told the same panel earlier this year that Iraqi oil revenues would finance the country's reconstruction. More U.S. Marines and sailors who are in Liberia are being hospitalized after showing symptoms of malaria. Nearly a third of the 150 Marines who went ashore to assist West African peacekeepers last month have now come down with symptoms of the disease. More from NPR's Eric Westervelt.
There are now 43 suspected cases of malaria among the 150 Marines who went ashore in Monrovia last month as part of a quick reaction force to help West African troops keep the peace in Liberia. A Marine Corps spokeswoman said military doctors are investigating why so many may have contracted the disease, especially since Marines were given anti-malarial drugs before the deployment. Doctors are trying to figure out if the Marines actually took the preventive medicine, when and in what doses. 10 more Marines with malaria symptoms were flown to a naval medical center in Maryland last night, joining 31 other Marines and one sailor who arrived at the center over the weekend. Two Marines with more severe symptoms were airlifted to Germany. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Washington.
Republican Peter Uberoth has dropped out of the California recall election. The former baseball commissioner told reporters that he decided his campaign can't develop enough support in the time left before the October 7th election. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 79 points to close at 95.07 in active trading. The Nasdaq was down 15 to close at 18.73. This is NPR News. President Bush is proposing a new public-private partnership that would allow parents to rate their children's school against other schools in their state. The president made the announcement today at an elementary school in Jacksonville, Florida. Kevin Mearshart reports from member station WJCT.
The partnership is between the Education Department and the Los Angeles-based Broad Foundation that will provide internet-based data to parents on how their local and state schools scored under the No Child Left Behind Act. The legislation requires states to track students' progress from one grade to another. President Bush says the data bank will help both parents and educators.
People say to me, well, we can't have a measuring system because it's going to be punitive. Quite the contrary. A measuring system is a useful tool. A measuring system will allow people to know where they stand, relative to where they need to go.
Just under $5 million in federal funds will be used, with over $50 million from the foundation. The program will start with 10 states. All 50 are expected to be online by the end of the year. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Mershart in Jacksonville.
The head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is defending a Pentagon decision to keep National Guard members and reserve troops in Iraq for a year. General Richard Myers told a Senate committee today that the reservists provide important support for active duty soldiers. Myers said that the reserves are being used as intended during wartime, but he acknowledged that it's important not to stress the reserve system so much that it has trouble recruiting new members. The order to keep National Guard members and reservists in Iraq for a year was signed on Friday, but not publicly announced. In stocks, the S&P 500 lost 8 to close at 1,023. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This Thursday, September 11th, also marks the 30th anniversary of the military coup that overthrew Chilean President Salvador Allende and installed General Augusto Pinochet, who ruled the country for 17 years. In 1970, Allende became the first democratically elected socialist president of a Latin American country. The Nixon administration, which perceived the socialist president as a threat, covertly worked to overthrow him and then supported the brutal Pinochet dictatorship. That secret history is revealed in over 24,000 recently declassified documents. Those documents are analyzed, and many are reproduced, in the new book, The Pinochet File, by Peter Kornbluh. He directs the Chile Documentation Project of the National Security Archive, a research library of declassified U.S. government documents. A little later, we'll hear from Jack Devine, who was a CIA agent stationed in Chile at the time of the coup. A few days after Allende was elected president of Chile, the CIA sent out a cable which read, "The key is psychological warfare. The fuel for the fire must come from within Chile. The station should employ every stratagem, however bizarre, to create internal resistance." I asked Kornbluh to describe some of the ploys and bizarre strategies.
In the 6 weeks following Salvador Allende's election on September 4th, 1970, at the orders of President Richard Nixon, the CIA attempted essentially to transform Chile from a country of tranquility into a country of turmoil. That was done through a number of mechanisms, planting propaganda in the press, alarmist propaganda, of course, that communists would come to power, children would be taken away. Contacts were made both through the CIA and American corporations in Chile and through officials in Washington with economic interests that were based in Chile, trying to get them to announce that they were pulling out, that they were going to leave Chileans unemployed because of Salvador Allende's election. Multiple contacts were made between the CIA agents in Chile and potential coup plotters, Chilean military officials who would move against the government. More than 24 meetings were held. A team of what they called false flaggers, the CIA's term for deep undercover agents, who were flown into Chile and met with the leading coup plotters. And a plan was developed to actually kidnap the Chilean commander-in-chief of the Chilean armed forces who opposed a coup, who was a strict constitutionalist. $50,000 was passed to a group that was supposed to conduct this kidnapping. It's a very complicated history about what happened, but in the end, the kidnapping turned into an assassination. And instead of creating the opportunity for a coup, in fact, Chileans, horrified by this political violence, rallied around Salvador Allende. He was ratified as president by the Chilean Congress and took office on November 3rd, 1970.
Now, you mentioned this, the assassination of General René Schneider, the constitutionalist who was the commander-in-chief of Chile's armed forces. Well, just one little kind of bizarre sidebar here. You write that the State Department didn't really know the extent of what the CIA was doing to try to overthrow Allende, and the State Department drafted a letter to President Allende, saying, "Dear Mr. President, the shocking attempt on the life of General Schneider is a stain on the pages of contemporary history. I would like you to know of my sorrow that this repugnant event has occurred in your country. Sincerely, Richard Nixon."
That document is one of the most ironic documents from the 1970 period to ever have been written. And the truth of the matter is that the president told the CIA director, Richard Helms, that this should be a very tightly held operation, that the U.S. ambassador should not be told about it. This was top secret, compartmentalized, this particular coup plot in the fall of 1970. There was a CIA task force set up to run it. It worked night and day to try and promote a coup because of constant pressure from the Nixon White House. And part of what we've learned from the declassified documents is that the CIA had much more involvement in this kidnapping attempt gone awry than previously known. After Schneider was shot, with Richard Helms, the CIA director's authorization, CIA headquarters sent a cable to the CIA station commending them on this operation. The cable states, "The station has done excellent job of guiding Chileans to point today where a military solution is at least an option for them. The chief of station and others are commended for accomplishing this under extremely difficult and delicate circumstances." These are documents that I think are revealing, and they shed significant light on an episode that still resonates today in Chile and in the United States.
The U.S. had tried to prevent the inauguration of Salvador Allende after he was elected. When that attempt failed, did the CIA change its tactics in trying to change the course of politics in Chile and overthrow Allende?
The declassified documents are extraordinarily revealing on what happened after Schneider was assassinated. Allende was confirmed by the Chilean Congress and inaugurated as president of Chile on November 3rd, 1970. We know from the declassified documents that Henry Kissinger pushed Richard Nixon to convene a National Security Council meeting and basically lay down the law to the rest of the U.S. foreign policy establishment on what U.S. policy should be. Kissinger sent Nixon a set of briefing papers on November 5th, 1970, the day before this meeting, warning him that he faced a momentous decision that would have critical implications for the future of U.S. foreign policy. This was really a kind of an exaggeration of the threat that the United States faced. But Kissinger warned Nixon that the State Department was willing to live with Allende, and that if Nixon didn't make it clear to everybody that he opposed Allende, wanted to hurt Allende and bring him down, that there would be a drift towards a modus vivendi with Allende.
What does modus vivendi mean?
It means to arrive at a state of coexistence with another country. And this meeting was held the next day at the National Security Council. The president did make it clear that the policy was to hurt Allende. It was going to be done in a very careful way so as not to alert the world that the United States was trying to undermine a democratically elected government. A few weeks later, Henry Kissinger, working with the CIA, presented Nixon with a 5-point covert operations plan to, quote, keep Allende from being able to consolidate his government, unquote.
What were some of the propaganda projects that the United States backed or initiated in Chile to try to discredit Allende?
Well, the CIA ran a number of propaganda projects. They had a significant propaganda operation which focused on financing Chile's leading newspaper, El Mercurio. The CIA already knew that the owner of El Mercurio, Agustin Edwards, was avidly in favor of a coup in Chile. Edwards had come to the United States right after Allende's election and met with CIA Director Richard Helms and discussed the issue of trying to foster a coup in Chile. We have a declassified memorandum of conversation of their meeting now. Richard Nixon, the President of the United States, personally authorized the expenditure of $1 million to bolster El Mercurio in Chile in 1971. Presidents do not often micromanage a covert operation, let alone the financing of a foreign newspaper. But in this case, because Kissinger and his aides were divided over whether to continue financing the paper, Nixon did weigh in, and Kissinger called the CIA and said, yes, put that $1 million in there. Over the course of the 3 years, more than $2 million was spent to bolster this newspaper. So that was one aspect of the propaganda project. The CIA put a number of Chilean journalists and editors on the payroll. They sponsored the creation of a number of small radio stations, mimeographs. There was quite a significant propaganda project. And we spend time talking about it because even though U.S. officials have denied that the United States played any direct role in the coup of September 11, 1973, we do have declassified CIA internal memoranda which say that their propaganda project, quote, helped set the stage for the coup of 11 September 1973.
So your reading of the documents is that the CIA wasn't directly involved in the coup per se, but it just tried to create an atmosphere that made the coup possible.
I conclude in the book that the United States, both overtly and through the CIA covertly, actively attempted to create a climate in which a coup was possible in Chile. The CIA, in the end, did not directly participate in the coup, meaning being directly involved in planning with Chilean military officers, offering equipment and money and guarantees, etc., for three reasons, which I don't think I really understood. I don't think we really understood until these documents were declassified. Very quickly, the first reason was that the CIA didn't believe that conditions were propitious for a coup until the end of August of 1973, when the commander-in-chief of the Chilean Armed Forces, Carlos Prats, was removed and General Pinochet replaced him. The second reason was that the CIA was under scrutiny in the United States for having collaborated with the IT&T Corporation in the fall of 1970 in covertly trying to keep Allende from taking office. The columnist Jack Anderson had broken the story using internal IT&T papers of CIA ITT conspiracies to block Allende. There was the Senate was actually holding hearings in mid-1973, and CIA officers were being called up to testify for the very first time, really, in the agency's history. And so CIA officials were extremely cautious about being clearly and directly involved with coup plotting while that was going on back in Washington. And the third reason, which draws on the second, is that the CIA had determined that direct U.S. support for the coup was not necessary for the coup to succeed. And since it wasn't necessary for the coup to succeed, the risks of exposure in undertaking it weren't really warranted.
I'd like to ask you to choose one of the many documents in this book that you think is most revelatory and read an excerpt of it for us.
I think one of the ones that is most revealing is a transcript of a conversation between Henry Kissinger and Augusto Pinochet on June 8th, 1976. And the reason this secret transcript is important is because Kissinger wrote about this meeting in the third volume of his memoirs and cast the meeting in a certain way. He said he had talked to Pinochet about human rights issues and about democracy. And we now have the transcript of that meeting, and I republished it in the book. And it makes it clear that really Kissinger passed over the issue of human rights and democracy. He didn't mention the word democracy at all in the meeting, by the way. And to the degree he talked about human rights, he talked about it because the U.S. Congress was, he said, forcing him to address this issue. And even though we have the documents, the briefing papers for him, which tell him, do not go in and give Pinochet platitudes, et cetera. You have to be very, very clear with him. Otherwise, he will come away from this meeting thinking you support him. At the end of this meeting, Kissinger was very clear with Pinochet. We want to help, not undermine you, he says. You did a great service to the West in overthrowing Allende. Otherwise, Chile would have followed Cuba. Then there would have been no human rights. And here he is talking to someone 3 years into the Pinochet regime who's ultimately responsible for the most egregious acts of human rights violations that the Southern Cone had seen to that point. Kissinger knows this full well. You have the ability to understand the way policymakers talk to dictators like Augusto Pinochet and really what they thought about them in the end.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Kornbluh, author of the new book, The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Kornbluh, author of the new book, The Pinochet File. It collects and analyzes many of the recently declassified documents showing America's covert policy toward Chile. You say in the book that Pinochet was brutal right from the start. He initiated a series of massacres that came to be known as the Caravan of Death. You say the United States intelligence knew about these massacres. What did it do in response? What was its reaction?
We have the CIA cables reporting from the day of the coup onward on the atrocities that were taking place. There was so much bloodshed in the days following the coup, Terry, that the CIA sources couldn't even accurately count it. And you had CIA cables dated 3 or 4 days after the coup coming up from Santiago saying that a source had said that 4,000 people had been killed in the first week following the coup. Another source reporting a week later that 2,000 to 10,000 civilians had been killed in the first 10 days or so following the coup. And eventually the CIA did intercept a secret report that was given to Pinochet on the actual figures. It showed about 1,400 to 1,500 people killed in the first 3 weeks after the coup, at least 320 to 400 of them summarily executed. From the very start, it was clear from intelligence reporting, as well as from reporting in papers such as the New York Times, that this was a brutal regime. There's one extraordinary document I came across, which I'll share with you, which is a secret transcript of Henry Kissinger meeting with his staff at the State Department on October 1st or 2nd, I believe, about 3 weeks after the coup. And his assistant secretary for Latin America comes in and says, you know, I'm testifying before Congress, and they're asking me about these atrocity stories that are appearing in Newsweek and the New York Times. I mean, can it be true, these extraordinary figures of how many people have been killed? And Kissinger responds to his entire staff. He says, I want our policy to be clear. However bad this military government behaves, it is better for our interests than Allende's was. And that was the policy that was pursued, an embrace of Augusto Pinochet after he took power, irregardless of the vast human rights atrocities he was committing.
When Pinochet was basically voted out of office, had the United States already turned against him? Did they want to keep him at that point? Or was it, did the U.S. government and the CIA consider it in its best interest to let him go?
Let's just go back to the beginning of the Pinochet dictatorship. Pinochet ruled in Chile for 17 years. His regime was renowned for human rights violations. U.S. intelligence repeatedly compared his secret police to the Gestapo in secret cables to Washington. For the first 3 years of the Pinochet era, which was the end of the Nixon administration and the 2 years of the Ford administration, U.S. policy was to support Pinochet. Kissinger really oversaw this policy. We tried to send as much military aid as we could. Eventually, the American public and the U.S. Congress got so outraged that that Senator Kennedy led a campaign to pass laws that would restrict aid to Augusto Pinochet. It was in September of 1976 when Augusto Pinochet and his secret police sent agents to Washington to commit an act of international terrorism, the car bombing that killed former Chilean ambassador Orlando Letelier and an American colleague, Ronnie Carpen Moffat, in downtown Washington, that U.S. policy was forced to start to change. This corresponded with Jimmy Carter's administration, which was much more focused on human rights. When Ronald Reagan was elected and became president, he embraced the Pinochet regime once again and removed the human rights issue from the bilateral relations with Chile. But by the beginning of his second term, it had become clear to Reagan's aides that Pinochet was becoming an albatross for U.S. policy. U.S. support for him was compromising efforts to get Congress to pass aid for the CIA's covert war in Nicaragua and military aid for the militaries in Salvador and Honduras. Reagan was being accused of a double standard in supporting Pinochet, but then supposedly working to promote democracy through the Contra War in Central America. And frankly, Pinochet was becoming another Somoza. He had been there for almost 15 years at that point. He was still committing atrocities. He was not letting the middle-class parties, the moderate parties, have any space. And the situation was radicalizing. The Communist Party was becoming much more active. There was guerrilla groups starting to reemerge in Chile. All the left that Pinochet, with the United States support, had tried to eradicate was reemerging. And so the Reagan administration did change its policy in 1986 towards Pinochet and started pressing him to hold a plebiscite. The Reagan administration did gain intelligence that Pinochet planned to violently abort this plebiscite if he appeared to be losing, and to remain in power. And the Reagan administration's, to its credit, the documents show, very aggressively worked with other countries, worked with all its contacts in the Chilean military to blow the whistle on Pinochet's plan. And even though he tried to implement this plan, by that time the rest of the generals refused to go along with him, and he was removed. To the credit of the Chilean public for voting him out of power under very, very difficult circumstances, and to the credit to the Reagan administration for the contribution it made at that point.
Peter Kornbluh is the author of The Pinochet File. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dell Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Cloud of Sparrows, a novel set in 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ken Tucker remembers singer-songwriter Warren Zevon. Also, more on the U.S. covert role in the coup that overthrew Chilean President Salvador Allende 30 years ago. We hear from Jack Devine, who was a CIA agent stationed in Chile at the time of the coup. And we continue our discussion with Peter Kornbluh.
Thank you. Every single cure seems to be against the law. I was walking pretty well, then I fell into a hole. I should climb out quick, but I hate you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about the covert role the U.S. played in the 1973 coup that overthrew Salvador Allende, the democratically elected socialist president of Chile, and installed the military dictator Augusto Pinochet. This Thursday marks the 30th anniversary of the coup. A little later, we'll hear more from Peter Kornbluh. His new book, The Pinochet File, collects and analyzes many of the recently declassified documents that reveal the U.S. support of the coup. Jack Devine worked on the CIA's Chile task force at the time of Allende's election. At the time of the coup, Devine was a CIA agent stationed in Chile. He later rose to the positions of chief of the Latin American division and acting director of the CIA's operations abroad. He's now retired from the CIA and runs a crisis management consulting firm in New York City. Devine says that to understand the U.S. policy toward Chile, you have to put it in the context of the 70s.
It's very hard when we look back at historical things to look at them strictly in the context of the documents. We were at a very different point in our history, and it's hard thinking back about the Cold War today. It seems so far away. But it wasn't just Nixon and Kissinger. It was very much the world we lived in at that time. We looked at Latin America, wars of liberation, communist takeover. And again, it sounds stale today. But in that period, it was viewed as a real threat. And I think it was in that context that the Nixon concern, if you will, should be understood. The second thing, which I think is terribly important in terms of the agency's role, this was not a covert action program put forth by CIA. In fact, it's an important point in virtually every covert action operation that I'm familiar with, and that is it's a presidential initiative. And in this case, the agency was quite lukewarm about becoming involved in a coup attempt against Allende in the period following the election.
Why was it lukewarm?
There's two points. One, they didn't think it would be successful. And the second was actually a time factor as well. In order to be successful, much more time would have been needed. But the ingredients were not there and was proven to be quite accurate, as a matter of fact. The ingredients weren't there for a successful coup when Allende was elected. The covert action program was much more limited. Even during the election, it was a denigration campaign, which means criticizing the candidate. It wasn't really getting out there organizing the parties in a more proactive way. The Schneider incident, which Peter refers to.
This is the general who was assassinated.
General Schneider was the commander-in-chief of the armed forces at that time. Was assassinated or killed, if you will, in a failed kidnapping attempt. But I want to make very clear that that was not a CIA operation, and it had a tremendous impact both with inside the CIA, but more importantly inside the U.S. government, in the entire political dynamic in Chile. It really put the end to coup plotting. It just stopped cold. The military itself had no heart for it. In fact, that's one of the points that I think gets lost in this commentary about the military. Up until September of 73, the military really was not in a coup-plotting frame of mind. They really, in the post-Schneider period, were not engaged in coup-plotting. What drove them to coup-plotting in September to the coup in September of 73 was the fact that their military institutions started to fall apart, and they felt they needed to protect that more than anything else, which was consistent with their mindset, but not necessarily mine.
Just getting back to the assassination of General Schneider, I believe what Peter Kornbluh says in the Pinochet file is that the documents show that the United States supplied arms that were used in that assassination and also money that was used in the planning of it?
I don't believe either of those statements to be true, that the arms were provided. I believe that is not accurate. And money provided for that kidnapping, I do not believe that's accurate either.
Are there things, you know, all these documents now have been declassified. You worked with the CIA in Chile at the time of the coup, but I'm wondering if you've learned a lot from reading these documents. I assume that you've read them. You should let us know if you have or not. But if you have read them, what are some of the things you didn't know were happening even though you were part of the operation?
I don't think it's so much, I mean, first of all, no one can know everything. And the documents aren't the whole story by any means. And one of the problems in looking at the documents, it doesn't point out what's taking place on the other side. I mean, what was going on outside of CIA? What was going on inside the Communist Party and the Russians and the Cubans? And what was going on inside the UP government at that time? All of that, of course, is lost in what was the U.S. government doing. And there are a couple points that I wanted to touch on. When we talk about the economy, yes, you can point to the ITT fiasco, if you will. But let us not forget there was a major expropriation of U.S. properties in Chile. And more importantly, there was expropriation of Chilean properties. It was a very menacing atmosphere. And I think people forget this. This was not just a democratic society at that point in time. There was a tremendous amount of turmoil and class conflict in Chile throughout this period. There was an expression used by almost all of the political parties that Allende, in the end, would fall of his own weight, and that's even from the Communist Party's own analysis. And I think to some degree, when we look at the economic circumstances, they really were driven by largely by the Allende policy. The cables were written inside of the U.S. government and what they should do and shouldn't do. We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that that doesn't necessarily translate into real events.
How aware were you of the torture and massacres that the Pinochet regime was responsible for, the regime that the U.S. was helping to support?
I'm very glad that you've raised that question. It's important to understand, and I think for your listeners to understand, that the agency is consistent with U.S. policy and our own values. Now, they change from administration to administration in certain aspects, but the participation in the torture and killing of people just is abhorrent to the CIA as it is to everyone else. I find it personally outrageous what took place in Chile during the Pinochet administration. I'm not a defender of Pinochet, and nor are any of my colleagues that served in Chile at that time with me. It was absolutely outrageous, and CIA had no forewarning. In fact, nobody I know in any of the political parties in Chile had a forewarning because the military was pretty much out of the political environment up until Pinochet came to power. No one really had a good handle on the mentality and culture of the military. Chile has a rich history of democracy and liberties and so on, and the Chilean military, when they came into power, I think many of us thought they would be in, settle things down, and then there'd be democratic elections and be back to business as usual. And it didn't turn out to be the case. And I remember talking to a KGB officer at the time saying that he thought Pinochet would stay in for 10 years, and I thought it was outrageous. And, of course, he was right and I was wrong. But make no mistake about it. Pinochet and the atrocity that took place, CIA had no sympathy, interest, and found it abhorrent. And frankly, to this day, I take great umbrage at the association with those incidents.
But it must have been an awful feeling to know that you were helping to support this man.
No, let's go go back. I want to stick to the basic point. CIA did not organize that military coup.
But it created the atmosphere that helped make the coup possible and then helped keep him in power.
That's what Peter's saying, and that's what some of the message imply they would like to see happen. It just is, there's a gap between wishes and realities here. The truth of the matter is the policy that was adhered to from the time that Allende was put into office until he was overthrown, the policy was no coup plotting. Now, what did take place? There's a lot of emphasis in the discussion earlier with Peter about negative media campaigns and so on. But it was largely, in many ways, supporting democratic institutions resisting what was viewed at the time as a Marxist onslaught. The Communist Party at that time and the leaders in Cuba and Russia, and this is well understood, viewed Chile as an opportunity to come to power through the ballot box. So there was a view of preserving. And I think the key point is the El Mercurio story, which I think is an interesting one that is raised here. What that money was used for was El Mercurio at that point in time was being pressured through print and ink and not being able to get some of the raw materials to maintain that very prestigious paper afloat in this difficult period. And the U.S. policymaker intervened to try and keep it alive. So there is a world of difference between using it as a hack media attack on Allende and trying to maintain this prestigious media outlet in defense of the democratic elements that were there at the time.
Well, Jack Devine, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Jack Devine was a CIA agent in Chile in 1973 at the time of the coup. Coming up, more from Peter Kornbluh, author of The Pinochet File. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Peter Kornbluh, the author of the new book, The Pinochet File. It collects and analyzes many of the recently declassified documents that reveal the secret history of U.S. policy in Chile, including its support of the coup that overthrew President Salvador Allende and installed the military dictator Augusto Pinochet. Could you quantify, you know, in numbers, the amount of money or the quantity of arms that we sent Chile?
You know, the Nixon administration conducted what it called an invisible blockade of aid to Chile during the Allende government. Almost all multilateral bank loans almost immediately ended to Chile after Allende's election under pressure that the United States put on the multilateral lending institutions. Credits for trade were cut off. The only trade that really significantly continued to Chile was arms to the Chilean military. As soon as Pinochet took power, despite the flow of intelligence documents and public reports of his atrocities, the spigot of economic and military aid was turned back on full steam. At one point, Chile was receiving, within months after the coup, up to 80% of the Food for Peace aid to all of Latin America. Chile became, during the first couple of years of the Pinochet regime, a leading purchaser of U.S. military equipment. I think it was the number five country at one point in 1975 in purchases of American military equipment. And thirdly, where the United States had gone to Paris and pressured all of our Western European allies to cut off renegotiations of Chile's debt to make it much harder for Allende to have any money to spend on imports and for his country. As soon as Pinochet took power, the United States worked with its allies to renegotiate all of Chile's debts, and really saving Pinochet hundreds of millions of dollars in the loans that his regime would have owed at that time. So across the board, aid and trade escalated, military support was forthcoming, and the United States gave Pinochet a rather open and active embrace during his first 3 years in power.
In the Bush administration's pursuit of the war in Iraq, we've seen disputes between the State Department, the Defense Department, and the intelligence agencies about what should be done and how it should be done. Can you describe if there were similar disputes going on during the coup in Chile, going on in the United States? You've said that the State Department raised questions about whether we should be backing a coup. Can you talk a little bit more about disagreements within the U.S.?
The U.S. foreign policy bureaucracy is large. Every agency has a different approach, a different vested interest. One of the things that the documents show is that Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger were essentially alone in 1970 in advocating for an aggressive, covert program to keep Allende from being inaugurated. Almost all of Kissinger's aides told him that this was impossible, pragmatically not really feasible. And second, his main deputy at the National Security Council wrote him a memo saying that this was a violation of the morals and values and principles of U.S. foreign policy, that Allende could not really be characterized as a mortal threat to the United States, and therefore the United States should not depart from its principles and try and roll back the democratic decisions of the Chilean people. One of the things that's most illuminating is that after Allende was inaugurated, within 48 hours, Kissinger had held meetings with the State Department about what we should do now. The State Department essentially said, look, he is democratically elected. He is the legitimate president of Chile. You know, we can support the political parties there, the opposition parties, but really we're just going to need to work with him. We really don't have any other option. Kissinger sends a set of arguments to Nixon saying, if you don't lay down the law to the bureaucracy here, there's going to be a drift towards a modus vivendi with Allende, and he will be able to consolidate his power and present himself as a successfully elected Marxist with dire implications for U.S. interests in the future around the world. And of course, Nixon took Kissinger's advice and made it clear to his aides that the United States was going to aggressively oppose Allende and hurt him the best we could. If Kissinger had recommended, perhaps, that we simply have a modus vivendi with the democratically elected president of a very small and strategically unimportant country in the southern cone of Chile, we might not today be commemorating the 30th anniversary of the brutal coup that cost Allende his life and brought Augusto Pinochet to power.
Are there CIA protests that have been revealed in the declassified documents? Protests against the U.S. policy. Anyone in the CIA saying, you know, we'll go along with it if you tell us to, but we don't think it's a good idea.
Right after Richard Nixon ordered the director of Central Intelligence, Richard Helms, to foment a coup in Chile in the fall of 1970, the order went down to the CIA station, and the CIA station chief, Henry Heckscher, wrote back saying that this was mission impossible. That Chile was tranquil, Chile was at peace with the election of Salvador Allende, and that there was no rationale, no justification, nothing that would make a coup possible. This was too large an order, he wrote back. And he sent a couple of cables making this point. And finally, CIA headquarters wrote back to him and said, basically told him to shut up. His opinion on this was not what was being asked for. What he was being asked for is him to implement the policy of the President of the United States to quickly if necessarily violently, foment a coup in Chile. At one point in October, when Heckscher had finally found a disgruntled, retired Chilean general who was willing to violently instigate a coup, he wrote back to Washington, "Carnage could be considerable and prolonged, i.e. civil war, but you have asked us to provoke chaos in Chile. We provide you with formula for chaos, which is unlikely to be bloodless." And he added, "To dissimulate U.S. involvement will clearly be impossible." And that was really a prescient statement. It was prescient not only for the operation right then that led to the violent murder of the Chilean commander-in-chief, General René Schneider, but it was also prescient for the overall U.S. Covert involvement in Chile, which contributed to the advent of Augusto Pinochet, and which has essentially been a very dark stain on the history of U.S. foreign policy ever since.
Peter Kornbluh, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Peter Kornbluh is the author of The Pinochet File. He directs the Chile Documentation Project of the National Security Archive at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker remembers singer-songwriter Warren Zevon. This is Fresh Air. Singer-songwriter Warren Zevon died Sunday in Los Angeles. He was 56 and had lung cancer. He had several hits, including Werewolves of London, Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me, and Lawyers, Guns, and Money. But his fans remember him for much more. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this appreciation.
Some days I feel like my shadow's casting me. Some days the sun don't shine. Sometimes I wonder what tomorrow's gonna bring when I think about my dirty life and times. One day.
Maybe you caught the VH1 TV special on the making of Warren Zevon's last album, The Wind. If you didn't, I'll describe the best part. Zevon is in a limo with his manager on his way to tape the David Letterman show. He's worried that his lung cancer, which is making him increasingly short of breath, won't allow him to both talk to Dave in the interview segments and perform the songs he wants to do. As he frets, his manager gets a cell phone call. She covers the phone and says to Zevon, "It's the New Yorker. They want to do a profile of you." Zevon turns away from her, looks out the car window for a second, turns back and says, "Too late." It's a great paradigmatic Warren Zevon moment. Turning down a chance for some publicity in a highly esteemed magazine for principled reasons, which boiled down to the unspoken message, "Where were you when I was healthy, making great music, and could have used the attention?" I hope New Yorker editor David Remnick saw that special and felt really bad. Looking at Zevon's exhausted face and thinning hair on the cover of The Wind, it's almost hard to remember the cocky, mop-topped young SOB who put out Excitable Boy in 1978, a great album whose hard-boiled lyrics and werewolf swagger put him on the map at an odd time. At the height of punk rock, here was a Los Angeles singer-songwriter whose pals included such musical establishment figures as Jackson Brown, who produced the album, and Linda Ronstadt and the Eagles, who sang backup on it. At the time, you'd have expected this young up-and-comer to pull back on his world-historical cynicism and his jaunty nihilism and behave himself for what might be his big break. Instead, he sang stuff like this.
Well, he went down to dinner in his Sunday best. Excitable boy, they all said. And he popped a pot roast all over.
chest. Excitable boy, they all said. Well, he's just an excitable boy. He took in the 4 a.m. show at the Clark. Excitable boy, they all said. And he bit the usherette's leg in the dark. Excitable boy, they all said. Just an excitable boy.
As always, I wonder whether Linda Ronstadt was aware when she recorded those nice ooh-wah, ooh-oohs that her voice was caressing a tune with lyrics like, well, he raped her and killed her, then he took her home, well, he's just an excitable boy. Certainly bad taste and worse never held Zevon back. His musical and lifestyle excesses have been extensively noted, though it also bears saying that he wrote some of his best late period music after getting sober, most specifically the terrific song Detox Mansion on 1987's Sentimental Hygiene, which contains the lines, "It's tough to be somebody, it's hard not to fall apart." Well, the last thing you can say about Zevon at the end of his life is that he fell apart. On the contrary, his best qualities only became more confident and sure. He had always cozied up to the Grim Reaper in songs like I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, and the ride referred to in his 2002 album My Ride's Here was a hearse. In interviews, he was witty and wry, noting that it, quote, may have been a strategical error not to have seen a doctor other than his dentist over the past decade or so. He was magnificent talking to Letterman on October 30th, saying simply that in those final days, quote, I enjoy every sandwich. I've read a lot of rave reviews of The Wind, Zevon's final album, released August 26th, and featuring guest stars like Bruce Springsteen, Tom Petty, and Emmylou Harris. I think these reviews do Zevon a disservice. The Wind is not a great album. Some of the songs are maudlin and vague. You can hear him straining for images and notes that his health will no longer permit. A man as ferociously unsentimental as Zevon doesn't need overstated praise or critical judgment clouded by excessive piety for the dying or the dead. He left behind a score, at least, of brilliant songs, and he was one of the most intelligent, funny, and scabrous figures in rock and roll history. His legacy is secure. We can honor him best by emulating his own clear-headed honesty.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Warren Zevon died Sunday in Los Angeles. He was 56. I'm Terry Gross.
Mama, take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. And I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Warner Brothers Pictures, featuring Matchstick Men, a Ridley Scott film starring Nicolas Cage and Sam Rockwell as a couple of pros in the small-time con, in theaters this Friday. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, economist Paul Krugman. He collects his New York Times op-ed columns in his new book, The Great Unraveling. He says it's about economic disappointment, bad leadership, and the lies of the powerful. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.